This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 19th, 2007. Sitting in for Out of Bogado, I'm Mitch Chesrich at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. A massive farm bill in Congress brings fears for farmers in developing nations. Turkey is facing a political crisis as it heads into this Sunday's special election. And more radiation has been spilled than previously reported at Japan's largest nuclear power plant after Monday's 6.8 earthquake.
They're sort of standing stationary nuclear weapons in a way. They won't blow up, but they can release all that radiation and you'll be dead.
We'll have these stories and more after these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Around 60 people were killed in three separate bomb blasts across Pakistan today. More than 200 people have died in a string of attacks since security forces stormed Islamabad's Red Mosque last week. Masroor Hussain reports.
Three bombs exploded in Pakistan today, one in the south and the other two in the northwest. The victims were mostly police, paramilitary and regular soldiers. The deadliest of today's attacks was a suicide bombing which killed at least 34 people in the town of Hub near the port city of Karachi. That attack apparently targeted a group of Chinese engineers traveling to Karachi from a nearby zinc mine. In the far northwest, a suicide bomber blew himself up at the police training center in the city of Hangu, killing at least 8 people. In the northwestern town of Kohat, a suicide bomb blast killed at least 18 and an army training center. Most of the dead are soldiers. Jihadi groups have launched 10 attacks in the past 8 days and in areas across the country. Taliban in North Waziristan last week vowed to attack security forces after abandoning a 10-month peace pact with the Musharraf government, which they said the government violated by setting up army pickets in the tribal areas. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Karachi.
The UN-backed War Crimes Court in Sierra Leone handed down its first sentences today to three former militia leaders. The three men were found guilty of killing, raping, and chopping off the limbs of civilians. They were also found responsible for forcing kidnapped children to become soldiers or to work as slaves in the country's diamond mines. The court handed down two 50-year sentences and one 45-year sentence. Former president of Liberia Charles Taylor faces related charges at the UN Tribunal in The Hague. Attorneys representing Colombian families affected by paramilitary violence filed a federal class action lawsuit in New Jersey today against Chiquita Brands International, charging the multinational produce company with funding and arming Colombian paramilitaries. Kat Aaron reports.
The suit alleges that beginning in the mid-1990s, Chiquita Brands International funneled money and guns to paramilitary death squads in order to maintain territorial control over Colombia's main banana-growing region. Plaintiffs say that paramilitaries with the AUC, or United Self-Defense Committees of Colombia, and its predecessors are responsible for assassinating hundreds of trade unionists, banana workers, and political organizers. Chiquita was fined $25 million earlier this year after admitting that it paid out more than $1.7 million to AUC paramilitaries. The AUC is recognized by the U.S. government as a terrorist organization. Prosecuting attorneys in the suit filed today say that Chiquita's actions also violate international laws against extrajudicial killings and torture.
It's not just Chiquita, it was all the banana companies in the area.
Arturo Carrillo from the Colombian Institute of International Law says that other companies have engaged in similar behavior.
This case is going to open the door to a great extent into one specific and egregious example of that kind of support. And that can only be done here in the United States. It would be impossible to do in Colombia from a civil perspective. And, of course, the criminal proceedings are confidential.
The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages for victims included in the class action. For FSRN, I'm Kat Aaron in New York.
Federal regulators have ordered Equistar Chemicals to start reporting leaks that violate clean air and water standards. The company must now install equipment to monitor pollution at 7 of its petrochemical plants. FSRN's Renee Feltz reports.
After being cited for air, water, and hazardous waste violations, Equistar consented to spend millions of dollars on pollution control and cleanup. Environmental Protection Agency inspectors found Equistar repeatedly broke the law by failing to report spills and the release of hazardous substances to emergency response centers. Benzene, linked to cancer, and asthma-causing compounds were among the chemicals leaked. Three Houston-area facilities, as well as plants in Iowa, Illinois, and Louisiana, will be impacted by changes Equistar will have to make in order to comply with federal regulations. Equistar will spend about $1 million on cleanup efforts. The Houston-based chemical company's violations stem from EPA inspections in 2002. Equistar is expected to portray itself as an industry leader for its correction of past failures and its agreement to spend millions of dollars on federal and state environmental projects as part of a civil penalty. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
A second day of multilateral talks aimed at persuading North Korea to give up its nuclear program wrapped up today in Beijing. Jason Strother has the story.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, that's the North's official name, has already shut down its main atomic reactor. However, no deadline has been set for complete disarmament. The U.S.'s top envoy to the talks, Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill, had hoped that a timetable could be set for the North to relinquish its entire atomic arsenal, but he told reporters that the North could feasibly disarm by the end of this year. Deadlines and timetables haven't had a good track record throughout the history of the six-party talks. In 2005, the DPRK walked away from an agreement, and again this past February, Pyongyang agreed to take the first step, but backtracked soon after. North Korea has demanded that the U.S. prove that South Korea is free of nuclear weapons. Both Seoul and Washington affirm that all nuclear warheads were removed back in 1991. The talks that include the U.S., both Koreas, China, Japan, and Russia will conclude on Friday. For Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Farm Bill, a massive piece of legislation renewed every 5 years in Congress, is once again up for consideration this year. Provisions in the measure include attempts to move U.S. agriculture in the direction of more organic and local farming. It would also expand low-income food assistance programs and spread the distribution of government assistance to disadvantaged farmers. But not everyone is pleased about the bill. Free Speech Radio News' Leanne Caldwell reports that it could have a dreadful impact on developing nations.
The last farm bill in 2002 catered to the powerful agriculture lobby. They gave nearly $60 million to congressional candidates in 2004, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. That resulted in the top 10% of farms receiving the majority of government subsidies. This makes conditions difficult for farmer Victor Almazan of Salinas, California.
My farm is really small. I have only 2 acres. I grow corn, peppers, zucchini, a lot of vegetables, organic vegetables.
He's a new farmer, which makes it tough to acquire loans. His farm is small, he grows vegetables, and they're organic, all things that make it more difficult for him to receive government assistance. A House panel is close to completing a new farm bill. Victor is in Washington, D.C. this week to lobby Congress, which has vowed to reform the system.
I'm selling my produce to Mexican stores. I'm trying to reach the Mexican market. I think it's really big, but Mexican people are not buying organic because they think it's really expensive. But we are trying to sell to low-income people at really low prices.
He's hoping to see a little bit of assistance from the government to help him expand and to better connect with the community market. And this new farm bill might just do that. It acknowledges the importance of fruits and vegetables and food security. After a hiatus, it could once again provide government assistance to fruit and vegetable farmers. It could also provide incentives for local and organic farms. It does expand $4 billion of funding for the school lunch and low-income food stamp program. And it emphasizes healthy, local food. In addition, Victor might be able to obtain that loan he's been waiting to buy new land to expand his farm, something that's been difficult for small, new, and minority farmers to do in recent years. Although these new priorities will provide some benefits for disadvantaged farmers, the emphasis on large commodities is still prevalent. Soybean, cotton, corn, wheat, and rice are still the only crops eligible for the $7 billion government subsidy program known as commodities. The system encourages overproducing because of guaranteed profits paid from taxpayers' dollars. Those are also the main crops the U.S. exports. Jim French, lead organizer for Oxfam America, says the House legislators haven't considered repealing the way this program affects international trade.
We feel like at a time when we need to be a good global citizen, that the House of Representatives has basically thumbed their nose at our trade negotiations, at the rules that the very poorest nations have to play by, and went forward with a status quo and are engaging in activities that probably have already been judged illegal under current trade agreements.
Congressman Payne of New Jersey says the U.S. Farm Bill must take into account the developing world.
80% of Africa is agriculture. People live in rural areas. It would make sense that we could alleviate worldwide, help alleviate a lot of the poverty worldwide, and where we wouldn't be in a position of having to send food to Africa. It really doesn't make sense.
Minority farmers in the U.S. have also seen negative repercussions of U.S. farm policy, in part due to an emphasis on commodities and large farms. According to Oxfam, the number of minority-owned farms has decreased by 97% since 1930. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
There are growing fears of power shortages in Japan after the world's largest nuclear power plant was knocked offline there during a 6.8 earthquake on Monday. Reportedly, the Japanese government wants the Kashiwazaki plant to remain closed for at least a year as it undergoes repairs and safety checks. It has been learned that the reported number of barrels containing low-level nuclear waste that tipped over is larger than previously reported, from 100 barrels to 400. Meanwhile, calls are beginning to emerge for nuclear power plants around the world to be more transparent in how they safeguard their hazardous materials from a possible radioactive leak. Free Speech Radio News' Claudia Craig has the story.
Officials at the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency in Japan found a new leak today, separate from the one reported on Tuesday. Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, initially reported all clear at its Kashiwazaki Kariwa plant. It now admits to 50 problems and has revised upwards the estimated level of radiation in water that leaked from the plant. TEPCO insists that the contamination was within government safety regulations and poses no threat to the environment.
It's an amazing sense of psychic numbing that people in the United States and Japan and France and Europe live with, by closing their eyes to these huge satanic mills that stand amongst them ready to spew out their poisons and damage future generations for the rest of time.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, anti-nuclear activist and physician, has called for greater transparency on the part of the nuclear industry following this week's events in Japan. Eileen Miyoko-Smith of Green Action Japan, who worked with Life magazine photographer W. Eugene Smith in the early 70s, exposing the horrors of Minamata mercury poisoning, shares Dr. Caldicott's concerns about safety and transparency in Japan. Speaking from Kyoto, she told FSRN that Tokyo Electric Power Company in particular has a history of cover-ups that makes this latest incident very troubling.
With TEPCO specifically, they have a whole history of covering up, of lying to government officials, of cheating on tests, and this is just part of their corporate culture. It's just a concrete manifestation of the serious problems we have in Japan with its nuclear regulatory system. The committees that deliberate safety issues are stacked by people from the nuclear industry or academics who work for the nuclear industry.
TEPCO's problems began last year when it was caught operating nuclear plants with cracked nuclear reactors. It turned out the company had deliberately falsified safety inspection documents. Since then, one of the plants suffered a minor radioactive leak. Caldicott says, out of safety concerns, nuclear plants should not be sited anywhere in the world in earthquake-prone territory. A prime example, she says, is the Diablo Canyon power plant in California.
Diablo Canyon is built on an earthquake fault. So for the nuclear industry, A, to do such a stupid thing, and then B, to deny that it's dangerous when people are very concerned, and C, then to cover up when there has been an earthquake, is not just ludicrous, but extremely medically dangerous.
Power plants worldwide are signatories to the 1996 Nuclear Safety Convention, the first international legal instrument on the safety of nuclear power plants. It requires that members maintain a high level of safety by setting international benchmarks to which they subscribe and against which they report. The convention has 65 signatories, including Japan and the US, and has been ratified by 41 states. Philip White is an Australian activist working in Tokyo with the Citizens Nuclear Information Centre. According to White, more and more citizens in Kashiwazaki, motivated by Monday's tremors and subsequent leaks, are joining together with early opponents of the nuclear plant.
One of our officers has actually been in the area, and he said that people are beginning to say to those few locals who'd stood up to the power company over the years, they said, oh, you were right all along. And there are people beginning to say, who haven't said it in the past, say, we don't need this nuclear power anymore in our area. But certainly the general public is now being forced to confront an issue that the public themselves have not really wanted to confront. And now they realise just how dangerous these nuclear power plants are.
Akira Fukushima, the Deputy Director General of Japan's Government Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency, has now shut the Kashiwazaki plant down. Japan has 55 nuclear plants. David Wald of the United States Geological Survey in Golden, Colorado, says at least half a dozen of the others are also close to seismic activity. Several tectonic plates converge immediately underneath Japan, he says, so no plant can in fact be earthquake-proof.
The number of plants is actually quite large, and the number of earthquakes is large. So over the years, many of these plants have been shaken quite strongly, and we haven't heard much about that because they've been successful. So in general, the engineering is extremely well done, but Mother Nature always finds the weak links, and that's apparently what's happened here.
But for Caldecott and for those in the town of Kashiwazaki, the combination of nuclear power plants and large earthquake may be green, but it is also dangerous.
We are sitting on an absolute minefield with nuclear power plants everywhere, and you have to know the truth about these dreadfully dangerous machines. You know, they're sort of standing stationary nuclear weapons in a way. They won't blow up, but they can release all that radiation and you'll be dead.
For FSRN, this is Claudia Cragg.
This Sunday, Turkey is set to hold early elections due to a deadlock over several constitutional reforms proposed by the ruling party. That includes an amendment for the country's president to be elected directly by the people rather than the parliament. The ruling AK party's presidential candidate, Abdullah Gül, has been repeatedly rejected by parliament, as some lawmakers and the military accuse him of intending to rule according to the tenets of Islam. However, millions of poor voters appear to back the proposal. Free Speech Radio News' Tony Cross has more.
The Muslim call to prayer rings out over the Hajila Industrial Park, but businessman Tahir Nosachan hasn't got time to speak to his God. The high-speed boss strides into one of his factories. It's turning out towels for export to the US, Japan, Britain, Russia, and many other countries. Posted on the wall next to the wage rates is a quotation from modern Turkey's founding father, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk.
Ulu önder Mustafa Kemal Atatürk'ün bir sözü, çalışmadan, yorulmadan...
It warns that a country that's afraid of work will lose its honor and its independence. Earlier in his capacity as president of the local businessmen's association, Nursachan chaired a meeting with election candidates from the Justice and Development Party, or AKP. He's one of a new breed of Turkish Muslim businessmen who've prospered under the AKP with export-led growth. His factories, among more than 70 in Hajila Industrial Park, the biggest in Turkey. Kayseri, the city where it's situated, is the heartland of the so-called Anatolian Tigers. The AKP is led by former Islamist activists. But in government it has been cosmopolitan, pushing for membership of the European Union and implementing an International Monetary Fund program. Turkey, which suffered a slump in 2001, now has growth rates of over 6%. There's no doubt that business loves the AKP. Here's Istanbul-based ship owner Pekin Baran, who's an officer of the National Employers Federation.
As far as the economic policies is concerned, business is very happy. And the achievement is absolutely remarkable, because don't you forget, they were in majority, yet they accepted to submit their political will to a stringent IMF discipline. You know, they achieved in 3-4 years an incredible amount in political reforms. I mean, you can't deny this.
Trade unionists in Kayseri point out that Nursarcan's company only pays the national minimum wage to shop floor workers and closed down one factory when employees tried to organize. But at least they're officially employed, unlike millions of workers in the black economy who miss out on job security and social benefits. But opposition parties claim that the AKP has a hidden agenda. Outgoing Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül used to belong to a hardline Islamist party. And both the Republican People's Party, the CHP, which was founded by Atatürk, and the hard-right National Action Party, or MHP, say that if re-elected, the AKP will try to scrap the country's secular principles. At the moment, students and civil servants are banned from wearing Islamic headscarves, and graduates of religious high schools can't enter the state-run universities. Many AKP voters, especially poor Muslims who give it a popular base, want that to change. And when the party proposed Abdullah Gül, whose wife covers her hair, as president, the nationalists provoked a constitutional crisis. There were huge secular demonstrations led by women's groups in many cities. One of the protesters, Zuhal Güler, swears loyalty to the father of the Turks.
They are trying to destroy Atatürk's principles, but we are never going to follow them, their policies. We are completely against this. We are all Muslims and secular, and we are Atatürk's people.
Turkey's military regards itself as the ultimate defender of secular republicanism. During the crisis, the armed forces posted a statement on the internet accusing the government of tolerating rising Islamism and threatening unspecified action. But the CHP and the MHP say that the era of military juntas is over. Left-wing academic Koray Çalışkan believes both parties are desperate to retain their influence in Turkish society.
If we want to talk about real danger, it's mostly the danger of anti-democratic politics organized by Republican People's Party and subcontracting postmodern coups to the army. Now, with their website, with their reports and everything, the army is always in Turkish politics, and usually and unfortunately with the invitation of civilian politics like RPP.
If the AKP wins Sunday's election, it will again try and nominate a president, although maybe not Gül. And it may also go ahead with plans for the people to vote directly for the post rather than parliament. So Turkey's political turmoil looks likely to continue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Kayseri.
In a new report, Israel's comptroller blamed the government and army for failing to protect civilians during the 2006 war with Lebanon. The report says that Israeli residents were not substantively protected against Hezbollah missile strikes, and that towns where Arab citizens lived had virtually no shelters at all. Meanwhile, last month's killing of 6 Spanish soldiers in southern Lebanon and a recent attack on Tanzanian UN peacekeepers is changing the dynamics of the UNIFIL peacekeeping force deployed to maintain a peace deal between the two countries. Don Duncan has more.
UNIFIL's mandate since deployment last year has been pretty clear: to keep the peace between Hezbollah to the north and Israel to the south. However, things got trickier after the June 24th car bomb attack, for which a local Salafist jihadist group has taken responsibility.
And I think when that happened, it opened my eyes to this is real. It could happen to anyone, and You have to be careful.
That's Private Anna Kells, who is serving with UNIFIL's Finn Irish Battalion. For her and the force, the peacekeeping goes on, but under stricter, more alert conditions. Soldiers no longer leave camp unless on essential missions. This convoy used to ride with fewer escort vehicles and with its hatches open to let in air and light. Since the attacks, all convoys are longer and the soldiers are shut tight inside, wearing helmets and flak jackets at all times. Before, soldiers looked for any signs of unrest among the people or any evidence of military activity. Now, says Captain Joe Gleason, they have to look out for themselves also.
We're looking for any roadblocks that, you know, maybe shouldn't be there, like cars that are just abandoned, any peculiar movement from villages that you're going through.
But are these measures enough? Former UNIFIL spokesperson Timur Goskal says there will be more attacks and that UNIFIL's worst foe right now may well be UN inefficiency.
UN as an institution, not UNIFIL, is ages, decades behind developments in conflict. There is no institutional memory, there is no system in the UN whereby they sit down and decide what kind of a threat are we dealing with here.
Under the current mandate, UNIFIL lacks the authority to engage in counter-terrorism or intelligence gathering activities. With further attacks expected in the future, Professor Hilal Khashan of the American University of Beirut says UNIFIL needs to show its muscle now more than ever.
UNIFIL is not really aggressive enough. I think UNIFIL needs to present itself as a fighting force, and this is lacking, you know. If UNIFIL were to present itself as a fighting force and ready to take action, and this may serve to deter possible attackers.
But aggressive action is not a peacekeeper's mandate, says Lieutenant Colonel Mick McCarthy of the Irish Battalion.
We're not an offensive force. We're not here to carry out offensive action. We're here to keep the peace, and we are peacekeepers.
Short of a change in its mandate enabling to better tackle terrorist threats, many observers, like Goskal, say if command were streamlined, the force could better respond to the threat of attack.
You cannot have a peacekeeping force of 29 countries. I'm totally against that. That is suicidal, what the UNIFIL is doing now. There's a mindset in the UN, more countries make you more acceptable. No, it doesn't. It makes it more unmanageable.
UNIFIL will continue its peacekeeping, but the level to which it can remain effective now depends on Hezbollah and the Lebanese army, says Karim Makdizi of the American University of Beirut.
The fact is that today, more than ever, the UNIFIL peacekeeping forces really truly need, particularly they need Hezbollah to protect them, to provide intelligence for them.
With the emergence of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-like terrorists on the playing field, the interests of Hezbollah and UNIFIL have become more closely allied. What is important, says Makdizi, is that the UN does not respond to the threat by changing the mandate so as to make UNIFIL a more aggressive military force.
And if they were to become more aggressive now while the Al-Qaeda kind of groups are beginning their attacks on UNIFIL, then that would be pushing it too far. They'd be having two or three different battles at the same time, and they're not prepared for that, and they never will be prepared for that.
The convoy of peacekeepers has reached its destination, an outpost high up on an isolated hill on the Israeli border. Under the current mandate, they are looking out for signs of aggression between Israel and Hezbollah.
Thank you.
But for many of these soldiers now, the threat against them also factors into the equation.
It's the kind of thing you can't let play in your mind, so you kind of just learn to deal with it. Job has to be done at the end of the day.
In Lebanon, I'm Don Duncan for Free Speech Radio News.
Today's edition of Free Speech Radio News was produced by Monica Lopez and Terna Geisey. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Technical production by Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. If you'd like to hear this or other Free Speech Radio News broadcasts, you can go to our website at www.fsrn.org. From WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Jezerich.